You're listening to a program produced in 2011 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic lectures, readings, performances, and discussions that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic downtown Central Library in the heart of L.A. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To learn more about Aloud, please go to our website, www.aloudla.org. What if everything we think we know about what makes human beings tick, how we make choices, find our mates, achieve professional success, create happy homes, contribute meaningfully to society, and live according to important values and principles, is wrong? In David Brooks's new book, The Social Animal, The Hidden Sources of Love, Character, and Achievement, the New York Times columnist and best-selling author of Bobos in Paradise paints a new and surprisingly moving picture of how we really operate and excel. He draws on a wealth of current research ranging from the social neuroscience of empathy to psycholinguistics, from John Milton to John Maynard Keynes. It's a wonderful sorting that he does to show how life is dictated by the inner processes of imagination, emotion, and intuition. Brain science, he notes, helps fill the hole left by the atrophy of theology and philosophy. I love that quote. And actually, having presented some wonderful neuroscientists here recently, V.S. Ramachandran and Datcher Keltner, I tend to agree. And to convey this new psychological research in a very accessible way, Brooks creates two characters, Harold and Erica, two upwardly mobile, like-minded individuals, and follows their lives from birth to Harold's death from natural causes on a porch in Aspen, Colorado. Kirkus Reviews calls Brooks' book an uncommonly brilliant blend of sociology, intellect, and allegory. David Brooks is a frequent commentator on National Public Radio, CNN's Late Edition, and The Diane Rehm Show. He edited the 1996 anthology Backward and Upward, The New Conservative Writing. He's been an op-ed columnist for the New York Times since 2003. And I presume if you're here tonight, you might be among the many, many who find David Brooks's column indispensable. In a time of extreme voices on left and right, he plays the voice of reason, which is why so many people, I think, regularly depend on his writing. The New York Magazine calls him the essential columnist of our time. Our board chair today described him at lunch as the West Side's favorite Republican. Please welcome David Brooks. Thank you.
Thank you. I'd like to sue the Luther Library for having the coolest podium I've ever seen. So you should all give so they can have more of these. I feel like Captain Kirk. Open up things. It's a pleasure to be here. This is my third time here, I think. I think with both my previous books, I was also here. And since I know the audience and I know Los Angeles, I know you didn't come here to hear me speak. You came here to hear yourself speak, so I'll try to be brief. And it's a pleasure to be here at the library. I told the crowd at lunch that my devotion to libraries is such as that my one extremely lame act of being a juvenile delinquent in high school, some friends and I were out at about 3 in the morning, and we decided as to be true rebels, so we broke into our local library. And we did nothing there. I think we thumbed through some Agatha Christie novels. That was the rebel. That was me, the rebel. Don't get in my way. So it is a pleasure to be here. And I found myself in this weird position writing a book I never expected to write. I spend my life being a columnist, being a conservative columnist at the Times, which I likened to being chief rabbi at Mecca. So as part of my job, I was given a good piece of advice when I took it, which was to interview 3 politicians every day. And I can tell you from this experience, they're all emotional freaks of one sort or another. They have what I call logorrhea dementia, which is they talk so much they drive themselves insane. But what they do have is incredible social skills. And so when you meet them, they stand way too close to you. They touch you. They rub the back of your head. They caress your cheek. I had dinner with a Republican senator a couple of years ago, and he kept his hand on my thigh, the whole meal, squeezing it for emphasis. I told some folks at lunch about years ago, I was in the Senate press gallery, and I was looking down at the Senate, and Ted Kennedy met Dan Quayle, and they were friends, and they gave each other big hugs, and their faces were like this far apart, and they were laughing and joking, and their hands were running up and down each other's backs, and they were sort of moving and gyrating and grinding away there, and I was like, get a room, I don't want to see this. And of course, the king of this was Bill Clinton, and the story I tell about him, which I call reporting, but you'll call name dropping, was I was in a hotel in Boston in the lobby. He comes out of the elevator, sees me, and starts praising me for a column I'd written praising him, which he thought was particularly brilliant. But as he, the crowd sees Bill Clinton there in the lobby, they sort of gather, and he wants to sort of embrace them. So he keeps talking to me, but he's backing up so they can all hear. And within a few minutes, he's like 80 feet away from me, just talking. But they all got the Bill Clinton experience. And if they don't have it, they make sure they manufacture these social skills. So I was covering Mitt Romney in the last presidential election cycle, and he was up in New Hampshire campaigning one day with his five perfect sons, Bip, Chip, Rip, Sip, Dip, and Lip. And so he was campaigning. He goes into a diner, introduces himself to each family at each table of the diner, asks them what village in New Hampshire they're from, and then he describes the home he owns in their village. And he's going around the whole diner, and as he's leaving, he waves goodbye to everybody, and then he first names everybody he's just met. So I was sort of impressed by that. And then just a few weeks ago, I was at the National Institutes of Health in Maryland, where I live, and a scientist showed me a video of a girl with Williams syndrome. And Williams syndrome, from the outside, looks like reverse autism. And so the little girl in the video, she was about 18 months old, she only has interest in social signals. And she's in a room with a boy of 12, the researcher's son, and he's juggling things. He's knocking over blocks. He's trying to interest her in the material things around them. She has no interest in any of that. She just gets way too close to him and peers into his eyes just because that's what she wants. She wants that social feedback. And I'm looking at the video, and I'm thinking, this is every senator I've ever covered. But that's what they have. And yet, so I cover these people with these really finely tuned social antennae. And then when I see them on the campaign trail, I see the sort of a crude stock set of emotions, which are sort of crude artificial displays of anger or whatever. And then when I see them in the policymaking world, all the attunement sort of just falls away. And they become sort of human CBO reports. And they treat things in a dehumanized way. And so, for example, I was covering the Soviet Union and the decline of the Soviet Union, the rise of Russia. And in those days, we sent over teams of economists with privatization plans. But what the Russia really lacked was social trust. And so everything was stolen in Russia because people had no sense of trust within the society. And we were sort of oblivious to that. In the Iraq War, we sent over military people, but our leaders were sort of oblivious to the cultural and psychological realities of Iraq. And I remember asking a senior member of the Bush administration, I can't tell you who she was, I said, didn't you guys kind of get the culture of Iraq wrong? And she said, well, I don't really believe in culture. I think you've changed the institutions. You changed the society. And that's not right. We had, both in the private and public sector, a financial regulatory system based on the supposition that bankers are prudent, rational, self-interested creatures who would never do anything stupid en masse. And that turns out to me not to be right, that they are subject to the same emotional contagions as everybody else. And then the issue I care most about, which I've covered since 1983 with the Nation at Risk Report, is education. And through all that time, we've sort of bureaucratically restructured the schools, big schools, small schools, charters, vouchers. But many of these reforms have had disappointing results because they've skirted the core issue, which is the individual relationship between a teacher and a student. And people learn from people they love, but if you mention the word love at a congressional hearing, they look at you like you're Oprah. And that's language that's not permitted. And so the question became to me was, why are the most socially attuned people on earth completely dehumanized when they think about policy? And I came to the conclusion that it was part of a wider cultural problem. that for centuries we've inherited a view of ourselves that we're divided selves. We have reason over here and emotion over here. And the human race progresses to the extent that reason can suppress the passions. Or at least they're on a seesaw. And if you're rational, then your emotions are down. And if your emotions are up, then your reason is down. And that these two things are sort of opposites to each other. And this has led to a view of human nature that at our best we're rational creatures who respond in straightforward ways to incentives. It's led in the universities to a series of academic disciplines that try to understand human nature using the methodologies of physics. And so emphasizing the things that can be quantified and counted and modeled by computers and sort of amputating all the things that can't be. And so this, in my view, has led to a shallow view of human nature, a great amputation, the cultural effects of which are that we're really good at talking about material things in public forums, but we tend to be bad at talking about culture, and we're really good at talking about skills and things like that and professional abilities and the 7 habits of highly effective people and all that kind of stuff, but we're really bad at talking about the things that matter most, like character. Alistair MacIntyre, the philosopher, had a famous diagnosis of the state of our state when he said that we have words like virtue, honor, vice, courage, but we no longer have a moral system to understand how they all fit together. And so he said, imagine having words like neutron and gravity, sort of physics and science words, but you don't have any physics theories to understand how it all fits together. That's the state we're in. And so I think you see this bias, this amputation, in all sorts of ways. You see it in the ways we raise our kids, where we have sort of a tiger mom bias that many of us are not happy with, but we tend to live by anyway, honing our kids from, you know, pre-birth to get into college. And you can see it if you go out to an elementary school in a suburban area in this country, especially in upper middle class area. You watch the third graders come out of the elementary school. They're wearing these 80-pound backpacks, so if the wind blows them over, they're like beetles sort of stuck there on the ground because we're going to load them down with books. And then cars come to pick them up, and usually it's a Saab or an Audi or a Volvo, because in a lot of these areas, it's socially acceptable to have a luxury car so long as it comes from a country hostile to U.S. foreign policy. That's fine. And then they get picked up by a creature I described in one of my books called the Uber Moms, who are highly successful career women who've taken time off to make sure all their kids get into Harvard. And you can usually tell the Uber Moms because they weigh less than their own children. They're sort of at the moment of conception, they're doing little butt exercises to stay fit and trim. They're taking so many soy-based nutritional formula in childhood or during pregnancy that the babies, when they come, are like these toothless defensive linemen, these big 13-pound behemoths that sort of plop out there, and the Uber moms are cutting the umbilical cord themselves, adjusting the video lighting, flashing little Mandarin flashcards at the little things, get them ready for their Chinese tutors. And so this leads to the sort of junior workaholics of America style that the tiger mom exemplifies. And it emphasizes things that, you know, can be tested and show up in grades and SAT scores, but sort of amputates all the rest. And actually, when the tiger mom, who I'm sure you all know, had her kids learn violin and piano, straight A's, but wouldn't let them go to sleepovers. And I wrote a column saying, if you want to know what's cognitively demanding, you know, getting straight A's is kind of demanding, and playing the piano is kind of demanding. But sending a 14-year-old girl on a sleepover with 7 other 14-year-old girls, that is cognitively demanding. And that's literally true. And Stephen Colbert took my head and put it on the body of a 14-year-old girl and had me doing a pillow fight on his thing. So I don't have any direct knowledge of 14-year-old girl sleepovers, but I know what's demanding, and it's the social stuff, which sort of gets squeezed out. And then when we talk about morality, one of the things we end up talking about are things we often end up talking about shopping. We want to shop in ways, and my first book was really about this, that ways that make us feel morally uplifted. And so we go to Ben and Jerry's ice cream, the ice cream company with its own foreign policy. I joked in that book that Ben and Jerry's should make a pacifist toothpaste, doesn't kill germs, just ask them to leave. That would be a big seller. Or else we shop at, you know, the Whole Foods markets, the Trader Joe's, the morally uplifting grocery stores where all the cashiers look like they're on loan from Amnesty International. And the What we get in my household is called veggie booty with kale, these seaweed-based snacks for kids who come home and say, Mom, I want a snack that'll help prevent colon rectal cancer. And so this is sort of the prevailing breeze in our culture, which steers us or pushes us in a direction that maybe is not as deep as we could be. And in the course of really reading about why kids were dropping out of high school, covering all these policy failures, and then trying to understand the sort of some of the weaknesses of American culture, I came across this field of research that really answered some of these problems, that got through the Great Amputation and got us, was really reintroducing us to the deeper aspects of who we are. And the odd thing is that it isn't theology and philosophy, that a lot of the most exciting intellectual work being done now on who we are is in the study of the mind, the field of neuroscience, cognitive science, psychology, sociology, behavioral economics. And the interesting thing to me about this work was that often it's being done using the language of technology and using technological whiz-bang gizmos like fMRI machines. The view of human nature, it really reinforces, is not a cold, mechanistic, deterministic view. It's a view that is an enchanted view of who we are. And really it points us in the direction of sort of a new humanism, and not in the direction of a cold scientific determinism. And if you take this research across these many fields, I think you really congregate again and again around three core insights. The first insight is that while the conscious mind writes the autobiography of our species, most of our thinking is unconscious, and that the central arena of life is not the voice we hear in the head, but the thought that goes on below the voice, that the voice is not even aware of. And so one way to think about this is that the human mind can take in about 12 million pieces of information a minute, of which it can be conscious of 40, and all the rest is just being processed automatically. Some of it is very simple. There was a patient named Ian Waterman who lost the ability to, we all have an unconscious ability to control our bodies at all moments. He lost that ability. And so painstakingly, over the course of years, he taught himself by consciously thinking about where his arms and legs are to stand and to walk and to move and even to drive. The problem came one day he was at his kitchen and the lights went out. There was a blackout and it was nighttime and it went pitch black. And since he could no longer see where his body was, he collapsed in a heap on the floor. And so this is just a fascinating example of some of the unconscious ways, the stuff we do automatically. Some of this stuff is more odd and really has interesting effects on how we live. So one of the bits of research I came across from a guy at the University of Buffalo, he found that people named Dennis are disproportionately likely to become dentists. And people named Lawrence are disproportionately likely to become lawyers because unconsciously we gravitate toward things that are familiar. My daughter, for this reason, is named President of the United States Brooks. And when you get into this realm, the unconscious is not, as Freud suggested, this dark realm of sexualized urges. It's really just a different way of seeing and understanding the world. And in many ways, the unconscious thought processes are quite intelligent. And so, for example, one of the little hints I got in the course of this research is if you have trouble making up your mind on a subject, tell yourself, well, I'll settle it by flipping a coin. But don't go by what the coin tells you. Go by your emotional reaction to the coin flip. So if it comes up heads and you're happy, then that's what you wanted to do all along. And your inner mind has made up your mind. One of the most cognitively demanding things any of us do is buying furniture. It's phenomenally hard to go to a furniture store, look at a sofa, and imagine what it's going to look like back in your living room. And so a Dutch scientist did all this research on how you should make that decision. And he found you should not make a conscious list of pros and cons of this or that sofa. You should study it, marinate with it, and then take some time, take a shower, take a nap, sleep on it, and then go with your intuition. Because your unconscious processing power is much more sophisticated at dealing with multiple variable decisions, like buying a sofa. So the power of the unconscious processes is the first insight. The second insight is that emotion is not separate from rationality. Emotion is not separate from reason, but is the foundation of reason. Antonio Damasio, who's here at USC, is very famous for studying patients who suffered strokes or lesions in the part of the mind that processes emotion. And they can look at horror pictures or pictures of atrocities, and they know what they're supposed to feel, but they just don't feel anything. And those people are not super intelligent. They're super dumb. They make a series of terrible decisions and often ruin their lives by a series of phenomenally stupid decisions, so they're not Mr. Spock. And that's because what emotion does is it tells you what to value. It's the valuing system in your mind. And so when we look at somebody who's done something brave, we feel a surge of admiration. We gravitate toward that thing. When we see somebody do something that strikes us as unfair, we feel a surge of disgust or contempt, and we're repelled. And so your emotion is constantly like a GPS system telling you what you like, what you don't like, what you value, what you don't value. And without that decision-making GPS system, it's very hard. Your decision-making landscape is hopelessly flat. You can't make good decisions. Now, I'm a middle-aged guy, and I'm not particularly comfortable talking about emotion. My wife jokes that me writing a book about emotion is like Gandhi writing a book about gluttony. And there's another bit of apocryphal brain scan story. This didn't happen, but it gets at a truth, which is they took a bunch of middle-aged guys and they stuck them in an fMRI machine, a brain scan machine. They had them watch a horror movie, and then they had them describe their feelings toward their wives. And the brain scans were the same in both activities, so there was just sheer terror in doing both things. And I sort of get what that is. But the fact is, emotion is at the center of our thinking. And it's not only at the center of our thinking in terms of valuation, but it tells us what to remember. If you have a childhood without too many emotional traumas, it's a childhood you will not remember in adulthood. And there are some people who barely remember their childhood for that reason. But it also literally builds the mind. And so there was one story of Romanian orphanages about 50 years ago, and these were horrible orphanages where there was really very little attention being paid to the kids. And some kids were adopted, and the kids who were adopted 4 years later had IQ scores on average 40 points higher than the kids that were not adopted. And it's not because the kids who were adopted were being tutored or brought to school, because they were adopted by mentally disabled women living in a different institution. It was simply the love between a mother and a child that helped wire those children's brains. Another story at about the same time, in 1945, a scientist named Rene Spitz looked at an orphanage in this country. And this was an orphanage where they decided the best thing to do to kids was to keep them germ-free, antiseptic. So they fed the kids, they gave them medical care, but they didn't handle them, they didn't touch them. And the mortality rate by age 2 at this orphanage was 37%. And they stopped naming the kids because they were dying at such high rates. And so the fact is that emotion is at the core of how our brain wires itself and what we remember and how we decide. So that's the second insight. The third insight is that we're not primarily self-contained individuals. We're not like units that create relationships. The relationships come first, and we emerge out of relationships. And so when it's the relationship between our parents that we emerge out of. We don't exist in any form before that relationship. And when we see each other, we don't only theorize about what each other is doing. We reenact in our own minds what the other person is doing. So when we look at each other, I'm not only saying, oh, you're doing this, I'm copying in my own mind what you're doing, a theory called mirror neurons, which was somewhat controversial, but the parts that the scientists seem to agree on is that when I look at somebody picking up a glass, even if I'm not touching a glass, my mind is reenacting picking up a glass. And if it's picking up a glass to drink, my brain will react one way. But if it's picking up a glass to put it in the dishwasher, it'll react another way. So the observation involves judging the intention behind the action. Perception and evaluation are part of the same process. They're not separate. And these are ways we deeply interpenetrate one to another. And we do this in many different ways, for example, through the sense of smell. Most of us, if given the choice of losing the sense of vision or the sense of smell, would probably choose, okay, I'll sacrifice the sense of smell. Vision seems more central. But in reality, people who lose the sense of smell have much greater emotional deterioration than people who lose the sense of vision, because so much of what we get happens unconsciously through the smell sense. And one of the experiments that I found interesting illustrating this was done in Germany. They took a bunch of people, put gauze pads under their arms, and had them watch a movie. Some watch a horror movie, some watch a comedy. And then other research subjects were paid a lot, I hope, and they sniffed the gauze pads. And they said, did this person watch a comedy or horror movie? And people could tell at way above average chance who watched a horror movie and who watched a comedy just by sniffing the pad. And women, by the way, were much better at this than men. But this is a sign that the brain is in our mind. The brain is in the skull, but the mind is not in the skull. The mind extends outwards. And parts of our mind is part of shared loops with other minds. And so these are the three foundational ideas that the unconscious matters, that emotions are central, and that we're deeply interpenetrated. And when you take this research together, you get a different view of who we are. We're sort of children of the French Enlightenment of René Descartes, who thought that reason was the highest of the faculties. But I think the research really vindicates a rival Enlightenment, the Scottish or British Enlightenment, led by people like David Hume and Adam Smith, who said that reason is weak, reason is slave to the passions. And the sentiments are strong, and what's more, the sentiments are trustworthy. And that's a different view of who we are and how we relate one to another. So Descartes and some of the French Enlightenment figures said the way we think about morality is by thinking through principles logically. That's how we make our moral decisions. Hume and Adam Smith in The Theory of Moral Sentiment said, no, we have certain social emotions, and those guide us if we're trained properly to do the moral thing. And so this is a different view of human nature, and I think this research really gives you, or at least reminds you of a different view of who we are, and gives you a different view, for example, of human capital, the idea of what it takes to lead a flourishing life. And when we think about human capital, we usually think about things that we can measure, grades, SAT scores, IQs, degrees, professional skills. But this research highlights a different set of skills, which are both rational and emotional, both conscious and unconscious, and really make a hash of all these different categories. And they point to these skills that we either have or don't have, as really the key foundations of living a fulfilling life. So among these skills, just a few examples. One of them is what you might call mindsight, which is the ability to enter into other people's minds and really download the knowledge they have there. And some people have this ability. Babies come with this ability. A researcher at the University of Washington named Alan Meltzoff in about 1979 or 80 leaned over a baby who was 43 minutes old, wagged his tongue at the baby, and she wagged her tongue back. And this has been replicated at phenomenally early ages, just minutes old. And that's because the baby doesn't know what a face is, doesn't know what another person is, but the baby knows I have to mimic. That's how I learn. I mimic. And that's a sign of how we interpenetrated each other. Babies are phenomenally good, by the way, at reading faces. So if you take babies and show them a bunch of monkey faces at 6 months, they can tell one monkey face from another. We lose this ability by adulthood because we don't have to pay that close attention to faces as babies do. Now, in this country, 55% of the infants 18 months old have developed a sophisticated two-way conversation with mom. And they know that if they send out a signal, that signal will be received. And those babies, which they call securely attached, enter school and enter adulthood knowing how to build relationships. And so when they go to school, they know how to build a relationship with teacher. And scientists at the University of Minnesota looked at the attachment patterns of babies at 18 months old, and they found they could predict with 77% accuracy who was going to graduate from high school. Because kids who can build relationships just have a huge advantage once they get to school. And 20% of the kids have what they call avoidant attachment patterns at 18 months, which is to say they send signals, but for whatever reason, the signals is not coming back. And so they have trouble building relationships. And one of the teachers in one of the books I read described an avoidantly attached kid walking into the classroom like a sailboat tacking into the wind, going this way and that, wanting to get close to teacher but not really knowing how to do it, and literally standing with his back to the teacher, just hoping the teacher would somehow build a relationship, but he didn't really know how to do that. And these kids have less activity in the reward areas of their brain during social activity. They get less out of a kick out of social interaction. And they do remember their childhood much less because there's much less emotional involvement. At age 70, they will have two-thirds fewer friends on average because they just have less attachments. Now, nothing that happens in the first 18 months of life determines a life course, but these relationships open up pathways which can be either confirmed or deconfirmed by later experience. And this ability to enter into somebody else's mind and really absorb and really suck out the knowledge that's there, share the knowledge, is just a tremendous, powerful tool if you want to learn. The second trait called equipoise, which is the ability to have the serenity and maturity to sort of monitor your own mind and to be aware of the strengths and weaknesses of things happening down below. The scientist's word for this is metacognition. And so, for example, we're overconfidence machines. 96% of college professors in this country believe they have above-average teaching skills. 96% of college seniors have above-average leadership skills. Time magazine recently asked Americans, are you in the top 1% of earners? And 19% of Americans are in the top 1% of earners. And 36% expect to be someday. Two researchers, Paul Schumacher and Edward Russo, gave tests to executives about their own industries and then asked them, how confident are you got the answers right to these tests? And in the advertising industry, the executives were confident they got 90% of the answers correct. In fact, they got 60% of them wrong. The most overconfident industry was the computer industry, where they were convinced they got 95% of the answers right. In fact, they got 80% wrong. This is a strongly gender-linked trait. So men drown at twice the rate as women because men have tremendous confidence in their swimming ability, especially after they've been drinking. But some people have an awareness of this kind of bias, this kind of overconfidence, and they develop crutches for themselves. Peter Drucker suggested one modesty crutch, which is every time you make a decision, write down your decision, write down the reasons behind your decision, seal it in an envelope for 9 months, and then open it. And you'll find that a third of your decisions were right, a third were wrong, a third were in the middle, but in every case almost, your reasoning will be irrelevant. And if you do this enough, you'll realize, okay, I'm not as smart as I think I am. And some people have these abilities which are not IQ, but are more mental character. Are you open-minded in the face of ambiguity? Do you weigh the strength of your, or do you adjust the strength of your conclusion to the strength of the evidence? And are you curious? And people who have these abilities think much better than people who don't have these abilities, and these abilities are unrelated to IQ, or mostly unrelated. Now, the third trait is what you might call metis, which is a Greek word for the ability to look over a situation and detect patterns or to derive a gist. So my newspaper did a great story about guys in Iraq, soldiers in Iraq, who could look down a street and tell whether there was an IED, a landmine in the street. And if you ask them, how do you know? They would say, well, I couldn't really tell you, but I feel a coldness inside. And that comes from experience and from careful observation. Unconsciously, you just know. In chicken farms, they have these people called chicken sexers who take newborn chicks and tell whether they're male or female. And they can do this with great accuracy, but often if you ask them, how do you know, they couldn't really tell you. They just somehow know. And these are perceptions that are beneath awareness. And so this is a form that comes really with experience. By teaching yourself through experience of perceptiveness to see the world in a different way. One experiment they took chess grandmasters and chess novices, and they gave them a five-second glimpse of a chessboard and said, memorize the board. The chess grandmasters could memorize the entire board easily. The novices could maybe remember four or five pieces on the board. And that's because the grandmasters did not see individual pieces, they saw formations. And so it's as if you were, instead of seeing individual letters, they saw a paragraph. Then they moved the pieces so they were in a position that could never happen in a chess match. And the grandmasters were no better than anybody else. And that's just different ways of perceiving the world. The fourth and related one is sympathy, the ability to perceive other people in attuned ways. And this comes in handy at work. Generally, most of us work in groups. Not New York Times columnists, unfortunately, but the rest of the most people do, and because groups are generally smarter than individuals, and face-to-face groups are much smarter than any other kind of group. So at the University of Michigan, they did studies where they gave people a math test, gave certain groups 10 minutes to solve the math test and had them meet face-to-face, and they could do it very easily. Then they gave other groups 30 minutes to solve the math test, but they had to communicate by email, and these groups couldn't do it. And that's because so much of our communication is by gesture, by intonation, by smell, and you need that stuff face-to-face. And the IQ, the capability of the group, was not related to the IQ of the individual members. It was related to how well the individual members could attune to one another, how often they took turns in conversation, how well they read each other's moods. And some people have this ability and some people don't. The fifth trait is what you might call propriety, which is the way to see the world in ways that maximize self-control and restraint. And so my favorite experiment in this whole field, which is the most famous experiment, which some of you probably already know, is the marshmallow experiment done by Walter Mischel. And just quickly, for those of you who don't know it, Mischel took four-year-olds, put them in a room one by one, put a marshmallow on the table in front of them and said, you can eat this marshmallow now, but I'm coming back in 10, 15 minutes, and if you haven't eaten the marshmallow, I'll give you two marshmallows. And Mischel shows me the videos, which are online, of the kids trying not to eat the marshmallows. And there's a little girl banging her head on the table, trying not to eat the marshmallow. One day, Michelle's using an Oreo cookie. Little guy picks up the Oreo, carefully eats out the middle, carefully puts it back on the... And that kid is now a U.S. senator. The important thing is that 20 years later, the kids who could wait 8, 10, 12 minutes, they had much higher college completion rates. And 30 years later, much higher income. Some kids pop it right in their mouth. And those kids, 20 years later, much higher drug and alcohol addiction problems and much higher incarceration rates. And that's because some kids grow up in homes where actions lead to consequences, and they develop strategies to control their impulses. And generally what they do is they learn to pretend the marshmallow is not a marshmallow, it's a cloud, or they put a frame around the marshmallow. They have some device, so they see the marshmallow in a different way. And the upshot of that is we develop habits. Through our habits, we develop different ways of seeing the world. One of the themes of the research is that we don't really have the power to change our mind consciously, which is why New Year's resolutions rarely work. But we do have the power to change our behavior, and if you change your behavior, you can change your mind. Or as the folks at Alcoholics Anonymous put it, fake it till you make it. And Aristotle understood this. If you develop habits and you persevere in those habits, you will build grooves down which your behavior will flow. And then when the big test comes, you'll more or less be ready. And so these are some of the traits. There are many others I could go into. One quick one I should mention here at the library is what you might call blending. We all know children who can say something like, I'm a tiger. And that seems like a very simple thing for a kid to say, I'm a tiger, pretend to be a tiger. But there's no computer on earth who could do that. Because to take a complicated concept such as I and a complicated concept such as tiger, and to merge these two things together is cognitively an extremely complicated task. And no computer could come close to doing that, but we can do it very easily, just unconsciously. And this ability to blend idea spaces together is what we call creativity. So what Picasso did is he took Western art, he took African masks, and he blended these two things together. Not only the geometry of these two things, but the moral systems implied by these two things. And so these are all different traits that are different than what we usually think of as human capital. And the final one I'll just mention quickly is a word that I sort of twisted called limerence. And limerence isn't so much a trait, it's a motivation, it's a drive. And what the conscious mind hungers for are the things that we write about in the magazines, which is for beauty, fame, money, success, recognition. But what the unconscious mind hungers for are those moments when of transcendence, when sort of the skull line disappears, self-awareness disappears, and we find ourselves lost in something larger than ourselves. And so it's what a craftsman feels when lost in the challenge of his craft. It's what a naturalist feels when she feels in love, sort of at one with nature. It's what a believer feels when enveloped by God's love. And it's what many of us feel at sort of the height of romantic passion, love for one another. And these are moments when self-awareness disappears. The conscious mind sort of retreats, and the unconscious patterns of inside the mind are in harmony with the patterns outside. and this is a state people chase. Scholars chase the moment when they've been working on a problem, and suddenly from somewhere down below, the answer bubbles up. And they feel this aha moment, this moment of epiphany. And scientists have done a lot of work of what happens in the brain at those moments, which parts shut down. And all the action is before we're aware that it's going to happen. Different things shut down, different things sort of spike up. And then a few seconds later, we think, oh, yeah, that's how it is. And these moments are delicious and ecstatic. Now, the decision to fall in love is like all our decisions. It's part emotional, it's part rational, it's part unconscious, it's part conscious. And in many ways, it's ruthlessly pragmatic. So we're all better off marrying people very similar to ourselves. The truism that opposites attract is not true. We tend to marry people very similar to ourselves. We tend to marry people whose nose widths are similar to ourselves, whose eye width are similar to ourselves, whose vocabulary levels are very similar to ourselves. We tend to marry people with very complementary immune systems to ourselves, which we tell by saliva and smell. We also tend to marry people who have as much status as we can get. And so, unfortunately, women tend to be attracted to men who are taller, though I did see a great study suggesting that a guy who's 5'6" can get as many online date offers on one of these online dating sites as a guy who's 6 foot tall, so long as he makes $172,000 a year more. And once all this internal logic is fulfilled, then the mind enchants the relationship. And there's a great Stendhal concept of the French writer called crystallization. And he talks about some salt miners who would throw branches into a mine. And they'd pick out the branches a few weeks later, and they'd hold them up to the sun, and they'd be covered in these shimmering crystals and very beautiful. And Stendhal said when they were in love and the heat of romantic passion, we crystallize our partner, and we imagine or assign to them all sorts of beauties and glories that maybe they don't actually have. But this magnifies the need. And when you look at inside the brain of someone in love, it looks very much like cocaine addiction. It's just a state of need. It's not really emotion. It's a state of need and addiction. And one of the most beautiful passages that I came across, which encapsulates all the different themes I've been talking about, the theme of the power of emotion, the power of unconscious processes, and the interpenetration of who we are, was a passage I came across from a scientist named Douglas Hofstetter, who's a brain scientist at Indiana University at Bloomington. And Hofstetter has written many great books. Gödel, Escherbach is one of his books. He's written several. And he was on sabbatical, I think, in Italy with his wife, Carol, and their two kids. And they had been married maybe for 7 or 10 years. And their kids were 5 and 2 when Carol very suddenly suffered a stroke and died very quickly. And months later, Hofstetter was in his bedroom, and he had a photograph of Carol on the bureau. And he had seen it many times before, but he happened to just glance at it as he was walking through his bedroom. And here's what he wrote about that moment, which is in his book, I Am a Strange Loop, is Hofstetter. I looked at her face, and I looked so deeply that I felt I was behind her eyes. And all at once I found myself saying, as tears flowed, "That's me, that's me." And those simple words brought back many thoughts that I had had before, about the fusion of our souls into one higher level entity, about the fact that at the core of both our souls lay our identical hopes and dreams for our children, about the notion that those hopes were not separate or distinct hopes, but were just one hope, one clear thing that defined us both, that welded us into a unit, the kind of unit I had but dimly imagined before being married and having children. I realized that though Carol had died, that core piece of her had not died at all, but that it had lived on very determinedly in my brain. And so the Greeks used to say we suffer our way to wisdom, and Hofstetter suffered his way to the wisdom that we are deeply interpenetrated one to another, and the loops that go into our mind are shared loops, and they linger on for decade and for century and sometimes for eons. And I think in a shallower way, the policy failures that I started with have led us to suffer our way to the wisdom that if you base policy, if you base life, if you have a culture that has a shallow view of human nature and ignores all these unconscious levels that we're now becoming privy to, then you will make mistakes both in the policy-making realm and in the personal realm. And the exciting thing about today is that we're in this time where these researchers in all these different fields are peering into the unconscious realm. And they don't really give us new philosophies, but they remind us of old philosophies. And they give us a new humanistic sense of who we are. And, you know, when Freud came with his concept of the unconscious, it really had a pervasive influence on the culture. And I think the research that's being done, and just really starting to be done, and will continue to be done for the next several decades, will have a pervasive influence on our culture and make it a more humanistic culture and a more healthy and a better culture. So thank you very much. Questions and soliloquies are now welcome.
Mr. Brooks, thank you for being here. The social skills that you mentioned, can they be learned like algebra and geography?
Yes, that's a very good question. Just to say something is emotional or unconscious does not mean that they're not taught. That we have temperaments which do influence us through life. But one of the things we do is educate our emotions. One of the ways we do it is just by who we surround ourselves with. But another way we do it is by what institutions we join. You don't often have the power, as I said, to control your mind, but if you join the Marine Corps, that environment will change you in certain ways. If you go to a certain college, it'll change you in certain ways. If you join a club, it'll change you in certain ways. And one of the one of the research I saw, that joining a club that meets just once a month produces the same happiness bump as doubling your income. And so these things have a profound effect on us. And then to me, and particularly germane in this building, is we have the power to educate our emotions through art and literature and learning. And so there, I have a great passage in the book from the British philosopher Roger Scruton, who talks about educating the emotion. And I'm not going to do justice to the passage, but you know, when you read Anna Karenina and you really move along with Anna Karenina or Vronsky or some of the other characters, you're tasting their emotional states, and you're adding to your own repertoire of emotional perceptions. And that's true of Mozart or Bruce Springsteen or the Ramones or anything. And so that's one of the reasons we benefit from art and literature and music and things like that, because that's how we educate our emotions. And the other theme here is that a lot of things that get dismissed as squishy are actually the most practical things. And so as we cut budgets, for example, in schools, we cut art and music, thinking, well, that's not really the hardcore reading and math. But in terms of educating the emotions, often that's more important.
Has your research and understanding altered your thinking or behavior in any ways?
Yeah, the first thing to be said is it's not my research. I'm a journalist covering other people doing research. I'd never want to take credit for the research. But it has in some ways. I said with my wife, I'm didn't come into this the most emotionally attuned Alan Alda-esque guy in the world. I'm reminded now. I was home over the weekend, and my wife and I were taking the dog out for a walk, and we were going to a park, and I came out to the car early and set the GPS so we could get there, and she had to gather up the dog and gather up the leash and all the other paraphernalia and bring it out a few minutes later. And as she sat down in the car, she said, "Okay, Mr. Emotional Expert, what am I feeling right now?" I said, "You're pissed off at me," and she said, "It's working exactly." I think personally, I've become much more aware of this lower level, and I see it not only in personal relationships. I see it in the financial crisis. I see it in the emotional contagion sweeping Egypt. I just see the world through that level. And then the final thing I would say, just in my own case, I think I'm much more communitarian than I used to be. We've had movements on the left and the right which really emphasize individual freedom. My politics have become much more emphasizing community bonds and how are those built. And my last book was really about the far-flung suburbs, somewhat of a celebration of these far-flung suburbs. But now I've come to see that density really has effects that maybe I didn't appreciate. So, for example, when you fill out a patent, if you do a piece of engineering or other innovation, you fill out a patent, you list all the other patents that contributed to your breakthrough. And the number of patents that are listed on these applications that were authored by people who live within 25 miles of the inventor is phenomenally high. We learn from the people right there. And urban workers see their productivity levels rise faster than suburban and rural workers because they benefit from face-to-face communications. So that's just quick examples of how I think I've changed my mind or my outlook. There's a voice, there are microphones.
Big fan of yours, probably because, like many in the audience, we might be roughly the same generation. Do you worry at all with the next generation, and even some in ours, as technology becomes so dominant and face-to-face is replaced with emails and all of the other electronic means of communication, that part of our generation, or more importantly, our children's generation, is going to suffer from that delinking, if you will?
Yeah, well, I do worry about that. And if you see my kids who are teenagers, if you see the number of hours they spend on Facebook and that sort of thing, you sort of wonder. And my kids get very upset if I even leave them a voicemail message. I should call if they're not there, just hang up. They don't want the distraction of having to pick up the voicemail. But the question is, does Facebook and texting, does it replace social contact or does it supplement it? And the evidence on this is not clear. And there are different people who have different views. My own view so far is that it supplements rather than replaces social contact. So people use Facebook, but they use it to arrange actual get-togethers, or they stay in touch with people they would otherwise lose touch with. And there's a body of research that suggests that it's not having negative effects on the social fabric. And I'm sort of biased in that direction without really being totally confident about that. Because if you take a look at social indicators among people under 30, they're phenomenally better than our generation. And so teenage pregnancy is down a third, teenage suicide is down, domestic violence is down, divorce rates for people under 30 are much lower than divorce rates for people over 30 after the same number of years of marriage. There's a lot of repairing of the social fabric. And so it could be that Facebook and texting and technology and video games are having a negative effect, but right now it's hard to see that effect in the data. And so I tend to be moderately optimistic about the effects of technology in not really replacing social interaction, but just supplementing it.
And
okay.
In writing your book, did you come across research that would validate a thesis that I would have, that some people are going to be, or many people would be, so damaged by their experiences that their capacity to experience their feelings or identify their feelings would be hugely compromised? That to me would seem obvious, but would there be research to that effect?
There's some, but it's not irreparable. In the first place, some people are tremendously resilient for reasons we do not understand. So it's either a quarter of the third of the kids who suffer serious physical abuse as children show no after effects. And we don't understand how that happens. That's not true for most kids, obviously. But the other thing to be said is, while earlier change tends to be more influential, as Jim Heckman, an economist, says, skill begets skill and learners learn. So earlier effect has the effect of compound interest. It's more influential. And temperament is influential. So there's a scientist named Jerome Kagan who measures kids' reactions to being startled and other things at a phenomenally early age. And he found they can change over the lifetime, but probably not deviate hugely from their original temperament. So a kid who's very extroverted, very young, maybe goes deviate toward the mean, that kid will probably not become extremely introverted. And so there's the grooves. But the other thing to be said, and I would say, so the summary of that little part of my answer is that we are influenced deeply by genes and early experience. But I would say the trend in the research is toward plasticity, which is to say that we have a phenomenal ability to make up for early deficits. And so a kid may suffer from these avoidant or disorganized attachment patterns at 18 months, but if there's a fantastic mentor at age 4 or at age 10 or at age 20 or at age 40 or at age 80, that'll really largely compensate for a lot of these things. And the other thing that is emphasized is that while the brain is much more plastic early in life, so if you have to perform these experiments called hemispherectomies where they take out half the brain, and if you do that at age 2, the brain is so plastic it more or less adapts, and kids can go through life with half a brain because it just sort of adjusts. But even at age 90, the brain is still manufacturing new neurons and new synapses, and people at an advanced age are still learning and can still change quite a bit. So, you know, some of the early influences are tremendously important, but it's never too late to change. I would say that's the emphasis of the research.
Two quick questions. I think you can tell a lot about people by the pets they own. So I'm curious as to what kind of dog you and your wife have. And the second question is, you put a lot of emphasis on early child development. Do you think the government should be investing more in early child development, especially with the lower income people?
Yeah. First on the pets, I have a section in my book about, I finished the book in Aspen. I have a special section on pets in Aspen. I don't know how many of you have been to Aspen, but there's a rule there that your pet should be a third as tall as your ceiling heights. And so the pets are like these 160-pound, like furry velociraptors, these things, all named after Jane Austen characters, just to have the right patina of intellectualism. I have a pet that my pet says less about me as a pet owner and more about me as someone who never wins an argument in his family. And so we have a cockapoo, a little black furry low thing. I wanted, of course, a big manly Labrador, but I lost that argument. So I don't know what you can defer. This pet is extremely friendly and overly friendly, and our relationship is complicated. Now, as for early childhood, the short answer is yes. We should spend a lot more on nurse family partnerships to send nurses into homes of single moms to give them help and coaching and how to be moms. We should have early childhood. We should have what they call the model is the Harlem Children's Zone, where they really surround kids with institutions and relationships. Now, there are a couple problems with this. One is essentially what these most successful programs do is they replace the culture of the home with a different culture. And so government is coming in a very paternalistic way and really replacing the home culture with a different, more achievement-oriented culture. And the family relationship is kind of important. I think we should all be a little nervous with governments coming in and interfering with that and really replacing it. And so I have some qualms about it. I also have qualms that the money we are now spending on early childhood is not being spent well. The Head Start program, which I support, is not a program that is really yielding the results that it should be. The teachers at Head Start are not the people who should be teaching. It's a jobs program. And so the results of Head Start are mixed. There are some really good Head Start facilities and some really bad ones. And the net results over years are you get some benefit, especially in social, but a lot of the academic gains, such as they are, fade away. And so we should be spending more, we should be focusing on it, but we need to have the same sort of reform we're beginning to get in K-12. We need to have that kind of reform in early childhood. But having said all that, there's no other investment that government can make that will have as good effect on society. There's nothing else. So I do support that stuff.
Can you share with us what you believe William F. Buckley would think of your new thinking now?
That's a good question. Buckley was my mentor. And he was an odd person in this regard. I mean, he was a great person and a great mentor. And he clearly had thought about this because, you know, I was probably 22 when I went to work for him. And I don't know how much he thought about this, but when he went to work for Buckley, he would edit my writing. And he would my little paragraphs would come back covered in his red ink, and he would say, "Come on, David, do better than this," that sort of thing. But he would also semi-adopt me. And so he took me out yachting, something that really wasn't part of my background. Took me to concerts, Bach concerts. Invited me over to dinner with big literary critics and asked my opinion about things. And so he was about as good and sensitive a mentor as one could hope to have. And so he really, his great capacity, was a great writer and sort of a raconteur. His enormous capacity was for friendship. And one of his biographers estimated that no other human being in the 20th century wrote as many letters as he did. He was a letter machine, partly because his brain never got tired. He could just go all day. I don't know if he would understand it. He would live this. And I always thought, though, having said that, he did grow up in a culture that didn't encourage men to live this and didn't even encourage women in many parts of this. He was not a WASP, but it was WASPy culture. And I sort of live in where I grew up. The slogan for our culture was "Think Yiddish, Act British," and so there was like a little reticence there. But he had reticence on stilts, I would say. And I learned that Christopher Buckley, his son, has since written a book about that family. And I would say they were like many people of that era and many people today, trapped in a vocabulary and a custom that didn't allow them to express the things that probably wanted most. And I, to be honest, I always thought the reason he was so close to his interns and his associates was that he'd really only had that one son and just wanted more of that. Okay.
Hi, I've been reading forever and watching you on the NewsHour. And so I can't help but ask, listening to you tonight and some of the, I think you talked about the Iraq War and banking, and it just makes me wonder, with all this research, why you're not a Democrat.
Because I never had that hemispherectomy. Now, I'll tell you, this research subsumes politics. And I think there could be sort of more liberal interpretations of it and more conservative. The liberal interpretations would emphasize the community, the power of community, and the power of common bonds, and when there are vast inequalities, that strains the social fabric in ways that are serious, and I would agree with that. If you wanted to take a more conservative approach, one of my heroes is Edmund Burke, who was a member of this Scottish Enlightenment, or British Enlightenment anyway, that I talked about. And his interpretation, or a more conservative-friendly interpretation, would be we have to be aware of how little we know about ourselves and how little we know about society. I think it was George Eliot said, imagine if you were playing chess and each of your chess characters had a mind of its own and you were trying to manipulate the pieces. And then I would say, imagine each chess piece didn't have one mind, but had 100 minds that were aroused by different contexts. Well, planning in that circumstance is going to be phenomenally complicated, and you should be modest about how you can plan. And so when people like President Obama, and who I admire quite a lot personally, say we're going to get the smartest people in the room and come up with a plan for the healthcare system, I want to say, I don't think you really understand it. I don't think any of us do. And so the banking system, we have this 2,000-page banking regulatory reform bill, which relies on regulators really writing a whole hundreds of thousands of pages of really detailed regulation. And my argument would be we need to regulate the banks, but because we know so little, I'm in favor of simple and stupid, overcomplicated and nuanced. So I would have just said, okay, we're breaking up the banks. And that's it. Just keep it simple. So I think being suspicious of that kind of any planner's ability to really do complicated social policy, I'm very suspicious of that. And that's essentially why I'm not a liberal. I don't get to choose. I don't think one more back here.
I also am a very long time reader of your column and have noticed the. This falling over into a more humanistic and philosophical sense rather than straight reporting or even editorying. And I'm wondering if some of the political people whom you are with all the time every day have approached you about that and had any questions about it, have said anything about how it has influenced them.
I've had, the book has only been out 2 or 3 weeks. I've had some emails from members of Congress who've read it. And one of them said he was weeping as one of my characters died, so that was a good sign. Usually they're weeping when they see my columns, but for other reasons. I guess my short answer to that would be the members of the government rarely have time to read. And when they do read, they don't read the way the rest of us do. And so some people say, is a columnist influential? But when I speak to a president or a member of the White House staff or a senator, they're not reading me to say, what can this person teach me? They're reading me to say, is he with me or is he against me? And that is essentially their reaction to the columns. Is it helpful or hurtful to what I'm doing? And so I don't expect that they, who are so busy, who have no time to think, are going to be reading and learning from it. Henry Kissinger had a good observation that when you come into government, you come in with all the human capital you're going to have. You're just spending down because there's no time to build up. And so when I think about my column or the book, I'm really not trying to teach the people in government. I'm hopefully trying to make life a little clearer for people who are not in government or who may someday be in government or may someday vote. So I don't really believe in it influencing people who are in power. I think they're beyond influence, and for good and ill. So I've heard from some, but I don't really expect to hear from many. I just hope they carry the book in a place where they can be photographed. So, thank you very much.
Aloud Audio is produced by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, Righteous Persons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, City National Bank, K&L Gates, KPMG, the Bujaki Foundation, Susan and David Rosenblum, Wallace Foundation, and Donna and Martin J. Wolfe. Media support provided by KPCC 83.9 FM and KUSC 91.5 FM. Additional support provided by the Council of the Library Foundation and individual Library Foundation members. Aloud theme composed by Larry Karish.